Completely Conspicuous, episode 444, November 1st, 2016. Welcome back to Completely Conspicuous. I'm your host, Jay Kumar. This week it's part two of my conversation with guest Brian Salvatore as we look back at the best rock of 1985. As always, we send any comments, questions, or leftover Halloween candy to jay.kumar@gmail.com. Also, please check out Completely Conspicuous at comconcast.blogspot.com and on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter at coomdog. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And now back to my conversation with Brian Salvatore. We need to talk about our favorite music of 1985.
We do.
Actually, before we get into that, let's quickly talk about bands that formed in 1985.
All right, hit me. I don't have this open this time, so hit me with
there's
these.
A lot of them. And it was interesting because, you know, we were talking about kind of, you know, the bands that you'll see kind of pop up later in the decade and in the early 90s. The Bevis Frond.
Which ooh, yeah.
You know, they're great. Big Dipper formed in 85. Crowded House. The aforementioned Drivin' and Cryin'. Extreme featuring Gary Cherone. Guns N' Roses formed in 1985.
Oh, wow.
And I believe they were kind of like there was LA Guns and then there was Hollywood Roses.
Yeah.
And then they kind of combined. Hootie and the Blowfish. Which
really?
Surprised me because they didn't hit big for like almost 10 years till after.
Yeah.
The Indigo Girls, which sounds about right.
Yeah.
Because they were kind of in that Athens scene, I think.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Jane's Addiction formed in 85. L7, Love and Rockets, because Bauhaus had split up, I think, the year before. Material Issue, which was a great power pop band.
Yep.
Pursuit of Happiness, another great power pop band. From Canada. Pussy Galore.
Uh-huh.
Radiohead formed in 85.
Wow. Then called On a Friday.
Ah. Screaming Trees, which I knew formed in 85.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Stone Temple Pilots, which I'm guessing sounded a lot different than what we ended up hearing because they hadn't had anybody else to copy yet.
So they were. They
what they sounded like in the early days.
They were originally called Mighty Joe Young.
Mighty Joe Young, yep.
And then the wonderfully titled Shirley Temple's Pussy. Because they came up with STP before they knew what it stood for.
Right.
So they were first Shirley Temple's Pussy and then Stereo Temple Pilots.
Oh, jeez.
Before settling on Stone Temple Pilots.
You know way too much about that band.
Hey, that's one of my white whales. That's a band I think about a lot.
Hmm. A couple more. A Tribe Called Quest.
That sounds about right, yeah.
And White Zombie. Mr. Rob Zombie.
There was just a big box set released of White Zombie stuff from that era.
Oh, the early days?
Of like their punk stuff, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because they were kind of, yeah, they were touring with like, with kind of punk acts.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of, I mean, it's kind of funny because they just turned into like a big metal band by
they really had those two albums though that were metalish, the two big ones, the Los Exorcista and then
More Human Than Human.
Yeah, but
or that, whatever it was. Whatever
Astro Creep 2000 or 6000, whatever it was, yeah.
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 Zombie Rules.
Yeah, exactly.
That was it, man. That made them.
I mean, absolutely.
If ever there was a band that was made by Beavis and Butthead, it was White Zombie. I remember seeing that and going, holy shit, this song kicks ass. Yeah. And it did.
you don't credit their cameo in the Adam Sandler film Airheads as
I hadn't seen it at the time.
I'm just kidding.
Bands that broke up in 1985 is a much shorter list. The only interesting ones that I saw were Hanoi Rocks.
Okay.
And that was because Vince Neil killed their drummer. Yeah, drunk driving accident.
Yeah.
Kaja Goo Goo, which basically was only formed, I think, a few years earlier.
From what I understand, they broke up because they were too shy.
The Minutemen.
Yep.
Because of D. Boone dying that year. Apollonia 6.
Because she and Prince broke up, probably.
Yeah. And Quarter Flash.
Okay.
The infamous Quarter Flash. So that's let's get into now our Bubbling Under albums. What are some of yours that didn't quite make your top five?
A few of these I'm pretty sure are going to make your top five, so I'm going to leave those up to the side for now.
All right. We'll see what you know.
Okay. So I'll leave those to the side. But Prince Around the World in a Day, we mentioned that before. That was, to me, Prince up until like 89 or 90. Almost everything he does is pretty
unimpeachable.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty great. Yeah. So that album, like you said, spawned Raspberry Beret, which was a huge hit, but the only real hit on the album. But, you know, I don't think if you have an Afternoon to Kill and you put a Prince record on from that period, you're going to be disappointed.
Oh, shit, yeah. It's so good. I mean, it's crazy like how much talent that guy had.
Absolutely.
You know, like, and all the shit he never released.
Yeah, and I don't know if we're ever going to hear that either. Because his estate was left in such shambles.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah. I mean, supposedly he had... Have you ever heard the famous Kevin Smith monologue about him?
Yes, it's really good.
It is. It's before Kevin Smith was totally up his own ass. Yeah. It was only partially up there. But according to that, you know, like, he has... like feature-length films and 50 music videos and dozens of albums.
Well, yeah, fully... like videos for songs that were never released.
Exactly, yeah. All this stuff. And, you know, like, I don't know if anybody will get the rights to release that stuff. And, you know, it's weird because I feel like up until, like, you know, I guess you can say, like, once he reverted to the cymbal.
Yeah,
the overall, there were still great songs in each record, but the overall quality slipped. But I feel like I don't know if, like, to
he lost his ability to edit himself.
Yes, but I don't know if anybody else could do any better of a job. You know, yeah. I would still kind of want Prince to curate his recorded stuff. You know, like,
I think he just recorded so much that, you know, I think it's just like Pollard, you know, Robert Pollard, where he's just like. You know, it's all good, but, like, they're just varying degrees of good. And at some point, it's just overwhelming and you can't deal anymore.
And occasionally they get on this tangent that you don't particularly dig yourself.
Right.
And that tangent might take 3 or 4 albums to get out of their system.
Right.
Whereas for a regular band, it would be, like, the B-sides, you know, because,
right.
because they're taking so long to make albums. Whereas Prince might make 5 albums in a year. So.
And have 5 more that he never releases.
Right, yeah.
Another song that I love from this album is Pop Life.
Like, oh, yeah.
I love that fucking song.
Yeah.
And after he died, like, I could not get that out of my head for the longest time because it's just so fucking catchy.
Yeah.
So good.
So that's one of my Bubbling Unders. Minutemen, 3-8 Tie for Last.
Yep.
Their last studio record. Jonathan Richman, whenever this Richman album usually shows up on here somewhere. Rockin' and Romance. Not one of his best records, but... there's a couple of good songs in there. A couple years later, he would do an album called Jonathan Goes Country, where he would have a bunch of country musicians sitting with him, and some of those songs originated on this album, and they're good. There's an SST band that I was introduced to through Frank Black, and that is Angst, and their album Life Light came out that year, and there's a couple of really, really good songs on that album.
I don't know them.
Oh, yeah, they were... it was two brothers, the Pope brothers, Joe and I forgot the other one's name, but Joe Pope, the bass player brother, wound up playing with Frank Black for, he scored this German silent film, Der Golem, a couple years ago.
Oh,
and
right.
Joe Pope was in the band for that. And the band is good. It's fast, punky SST stuff. It's all out of print.
I thought you were going to say Saccharine Trust or something.
Oh, no. I do like Saccharine Trust, but no, Angst. Mm. And
cool,
then
check them out.
The last one of Bubbling Unders that I don't think you're going to talk about is the first Big Audio Dynamite record. This is Big Audio Dynamite.
almost put that in my top five.
Yeah, it was right at the bottom for me too. Those first two or three BAD albums are just so great.
Yeah, and you know, I was listening to it today, just in preparing for this, and you know, it's funny because that came out right around the same time that Strummer put out Cut the Crap,
yeah,
which is the worst possible Clash album you could imagine, because you know, he's got like two dudes replacing Mick Jones, but yeah, it was. I remember at the time. You know, I was in college and, you know, listening to radio and hearing Big Audio Dynamite, like, it was so different from like everything else because of all the samples, the movie clips, and, you know, just sort of like, you know, and I was not a Clash expert, but I knew enough of them to go, wow, this is a really different kind of sound for this guy. And I'm still kind of debating like how well it's aged.
Yeah, it's certainly
it's
not
very of its time.
Yes, absolutely. I was just going to say that.
But it's not a bad thing, I don't think, because, you know, things are of their time. It was 1985. You know, not everything can be like timeless, but I still enjoy listening to them. But like, you know, I think especially like, you know, the sheer number of like old movie, you know, little sound bites in there.
They discovered their samplers and couldn't shake them.
They could have cut back on that. But I mean, you know, there's so many. The Bottom Line is such a great song.
Yeah.
E equals MC squared. I mean, it's just, you know, I love, and I saw them, you know, they did a little, a tour, I don't know, about 3-4 years ago, maybe.
Yeah. How was that?
I was fucking great. It was so good. You know, you know, Mick Jones is just, you know, just getting to see him do anything was great. But like, I love that BAD stuff. And, you know, they just had a good, you know, it was basically kind of taking, you know, the punk energy that, you know, he had in the Clash, and then kind of opening up to this whole world of hip hop and dance and, you know, just R&B and then, but still having a rock edge. And it was terrific.
The rumor for years, and I think this has since been confirmed, is that pretty much for every Clash song, he wrote the music, and Strummer just wrote the melody and the lyrics. You know, maybe every now and then Strummer would bring an idea in, but, you know, you don't, I think when you see them on stage or listen to them on the radio, you don't realize what a huge part of the band Mick Jones was. You know, he sings a song here or there, you know, so when he leaves the band before Cut the Crap, you're like, oh, that's a shame, we're not going to hear Should I Stay or Should I Go?
Right.
Or you know, what's that song? Rudy Can't Fail, he sings part of, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but like, but still, like, overall, you think, oh, this is Joe Strummer's band. And then you realize, oh no, he wrote, you know, 80% of the music, and you just, you know, you see what a huge loss it was. And supposedly, I watched this Clash documentary, and I might have mentioned this to you in the past, but when Cut the Crap was being made, Joe Strummer disappeared for a while.
Yeah.
And he went to Jamaica and was knocking on doors trying to find Mick Jones to be like, come back, please.
Right, right.
Please come back to the band. So,
and he ended up working on a couple of the Big Audio Dynamite albums.
Yeah, too. The next one he was a big part of. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the animosity kind of obviously died down, and, you know, they were getting offers like every year from like Lollapalooza and, you know, different festivals.
And they had just reunited on stage when Strummer died.
Yeah.
They were doing a benefit in London, and Mick Jones came out and did 2 or 3 songs with them. And then there was talk of them reuniting for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because they knew they were going in.
Right.
Or at least maybe they knew that they were up for it. And there was talk of reuniting, but, you know, it obviously never happened.
It's crazy to think he's been dead now for 14 years almost.
Yeah.
It's December of 2002.
Yeah.
That's just nuts.
What's crazy is that's almost the same time span between them breaking up and him dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they broke up in 86 or 87, maybe, technically. Because the album came out in 85.
Oh, 85, right? Well, I mean,
but they toured for the album.
Yeah, but, well, Mick Jones left in 85.
84, right? I think.
84, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's crazy. Any a couple others?
No, go ahead and say yours.
Okay, I mean, you know, there's a lot. I have a long list, but some of the more prominent ones: Smith's "Meat Is Murder," and I always you know, I think like really my gateway to the Smiths was How Soon Is Now, which probably is the same as a lot of
people. For a lot of people, yeah.
You know, and actually like before we had MTV, there was a channel in Boston called V66, which was a video channel, all videos. It was started by this guy, I think his name's John Garabedian, who's like a radio guy in the Boston area who just, you know, saw what MTV was doing and, you know, kind of started doing it in the Boston area. And we would get that. It was basically like a UHF channel. So like it was like, you know, channel 66.
Right.
And I could get that. I couldn't get MTV. So I saw like the Smiths on there for the first time, you know, because they weren't getting played on the radio. Saw, you know, U2 on there. So a lot of, you know, kind of interesting stuff. But that was kind of my introduction to this record. I didn't listen to the whole thing. You know, I didn't get it at the time, but I got Strange Ways and a couple of other things after that. But yeah, I mean, you know, obviously an amazing band, you know, at the peak of their powers in 1985, you know, just listening to like, I was listening to a little bit of it today and it was just like, you know, that's a band where like, I feel like that, you know, that's not as dated as like Big Audio Dynamite. Like,
agreed. It's,
you know what I mean? Like, it, you know, I think Marr, you know, Johnny Marr is just such a great guitarist. And, you know, I think people have been trying to do what Morrissey did, you know, in so many bands for years now. So, it's, you know, and it's kind of amazing that they haven't reunited.
Well, they hate each other.
Yeah, they must, right? Because
and supposedly the rhythm section that hates that Marr and Morrissey hate more than each other, which is weird because you'd think just they would reunite with a new rhythm section. Because right. Morrissey and Marr are the ones that people really want to see,
right? And Marr, like, has been touring a lot the last few years. And
he was in Modest Mouse for a while.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, he's been doing his own shows and, you know, singing. You know, I think he does, like, How Soon Is Now. He does, like, a bunch of Smith stuff. Yeah. You know, singing the vocals himself. But obviously not the same as Evan Morrissey. But Morrissey's just such, you know, such a head case right now. Like, he'll schedule these tours and then cancel them and, you know, say he's sick or, you know, say something outrageous just to piss people off. You know, it's you know, he's an interesting character. That's for sure.
That's a way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was, you know, that's definitely on my list. In Excess, Listen Like Thieves. This was kind of a, you know, I had first heard them a few years earlier when, you know, thanks to the video for The One Thing. But this was like, you know, this is the first album I got, and, you know, kind of before they, you know, they hit it really big with their next album, Kick, but, you know, this is still kind of, you know, when they were sort of in the alternative, you know, alt-rock kind of genre. I mean, I think Kick kind of took them, you know, straight into pop, but, you know, really good album. You know, great live band. I saw them a few times a few years later, and you know, You kind of, I think they kind of have an image of being like really kind of, you know, just sort of pop lightweights, but they're a really good band.
Yeah.
The Cure, The Head on the Door. I don't know if you have
that. That was on my Bubbling Under, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, they, In Between Days was, you know, I mean, what an iconic song that is. I mean, just like, you know, they're a band really that like, they've got like a bunch of great records. You know, Disintegration is a great album from a few years later. Actually, I think my introduction to them was really, well, I heard In Between Days on the radio when it came out. Didn't get the record, but I got Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me a few years later when that came out, which is a double album. And that's, I mean, you know, they're just like, there's another band that has just so much good material.
Oh, yeah.
Over a long period of time. I still haven't seen them in concert, but I mean, I've always liked them.
Supposedly when they play, the first half of the show is very much what you'd hoped it would be, you know, like the songs you want to hear. And then the second half of the show, they go real deep with a lot of B-sides and album tracks, which if you're a huge fan, it's got to be cool. But I have to imagine that most of the folks going to see the Cure nowadays, like, they want to hear the hits, you know?
The hits, yeah.
So it's going to be kind of an odd show to see.
Although, I don't know. I mean, they've been around long enough and have enough fairly fervent fans that I would think that there, a lot of people would dig, you know, kind of the deeper...
Yeah, but I think a lot of it's from the more recent records. So that might not be
like,
as much.
You know, like, Pornography is such a great record, and that's, like, one of their first albums. And I actually, like, got, like, a deluxe version of that from the library. It had, like, you know, a whole disc of, like, you know, bonus stuff. And, then, you know, it's just, like, so good. I'm still kind of digging through their catalog. I'll pick one more. Dinosaur Jr.
Dinosaur.
Their first album, Dinosaur, yeah. And actually, like, I was not into them in 1985 because, you know, I was into Van Halen. But, you know, I really actually, you know, I got into them after Barlow left, probably with
Philippine.
No, before the album before that, the fuck is it? Where You Been?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which is amazing. I was Start Chopping. I mean, once I heard Start Chopping, I was like, holy shit, this band's awesome. And then I kind of got into them. But about 10 years ago, they basically re-released like their first three albums.
Dinosaur, Bug, and what's the third one? Living All Over Me?
Yep. Yeah. And so I picked all those up. And you know, obviously, like, Dinosaur is more like, you know, more of a punk kind of album than anything they ever did after that. But, you know, they kind of started getting into more melodic stuff. But Dinosaur is really just kind of like, you know, them, you know, just obviously, like, and actually, like, Maskus was like a huge metal guy when he was younger, and then got into hardcore. So you can hear those influences on this album. Yeah. I mean, they just, and if you've ever seen them live, they're so fucking loud. They're still so fucking loud. But, you know, and it's funny that, you know, they originally were called Dinosaur, and then there was another band called Dinosaur, so they had to add the Junior to their name so they could keep going. But yeah, I mean, you know, Bulbs of Passion is a great tune, Repulsion, you know, Forget the Swan. I mean, there's a lot of good songs on this, you know, and it's kind of cool that they're still, you know, like their album that they released this year is excellent, you know? I mean,
yeah.
They, and you know, and Lou and Jade really don't necessarily get along that well, but they've learned how to kind of coexist because obviously there's more money together than there is apart. So,
and I don't think it's necessarily animosity. I think they're just two such different guys that they just have a hard time relating to each other.
Well, and they're both very, you know, awkward humans anyway.
Yes.
In their own way. Like, you know, Jay is, you know, practically, you know, like, he doesn't talk a lot. You know, I've seen him at clubs in Boston, you know, and said hi to him. But, like, you know, the dude just kind of, you know, he's in his own world. But, you know, and then I've heard him on, like, you know, WTF. You know, which is kind of funny. Yeah. You know, you got to kind of coax him out of himself, but he's hilarious. Like, but and then Barlow, you know, a little more outgoing, but, you know, in his own way is, you know, kind of a social misfit as well. So
yeah. I loved his album from last year, by the way.
Oh,
Brace the Wave. I really enjoyed that.
I don't think I have that one.
The Barlow record, it's really, really good.
Yeah. I have a lot of his stuff. I have a lot of Sebado stuff, which is, I enjoy as well, but, this is kind of where it all begins.
And yeah.
It's well worth checking out. What are some more of your bubbling unders?
I'm pretty sure that the rest of mine are going to make your list.
Oh, I see. You don't want to tell me yet?
Okay. No, I want to see how it goes.
Okay. I'll do a couple of more bubbling unders, and then we'll get into the top five. Probably the album I listened to the most that year, because that's where I was at, was Power Windows by Rush.
Okay.
Just because I was, you know...
You were that guy, yeah.
And I saw them actually twice that fall on the Power Windows tour. I saw them in Worcester, Massachusetts, and in Portland, Maine. And they were great shows. This was kind of into their more... electronic period where they were playing a lot of synths and stuff. There was still, you know, obviously, like, there was still a rock band in terms of, you know, there were big guitar solos and drum solos and things like that. But, you know, a lot more pop sensibility on this album. And the next one is Hold Your Fire, which featured Amy Mann singing on a song, which actually was a big hit. But, like, you know, they were, you know, it wasn't the same. You know, they were constantly evolving, which was interesting. You know, I think they probably turned off a lot of people, you know, in the 80s with kind of the, you know, as they got sort of more and more electric. But I dug it. So, and I will say one more. Jesus and Mary Chain, Psycho Candy, which is another album that I didn't, you know, I wasn't listening to then, but got into later on. I actually saw them at the 92 Lollapalooza.
Okay.
Part of that sick ass lineup.
92, that was the second year?
Yeah, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Ice Cube, Lush, Ministry, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Jesus and Mary Chain. Wow. I mean, it was strong, yeah. And they were, you know, they were great. But you know, going back, obviously, you know, I had heard Just Like Honey, but you know, just I kind of got into more of like that feedback stuff that they were doing. And you know, I mean, obviously, like, they've got a lot of good stuff, but it's, yeah, it's, you know, it's the pop. Is the pop kind of, you know, melded with guitar drone.
Right.
I really love that shit. So I'm a sucker for that. So this album's great for that stuff. So let's delve into our top five. What's your number five?
My number five is I mentioned before that a lot of my top five are records I could never have been aware of. Even if I had been, you know, 13 instead of 3 or even 16 instead of 3. And this one certainly falls into that category. It is the self-titled debut album by Beat Happening, the K-Records band out of Oregon. No, Washington.
Olympia,
Washington, yes.
Yep.
I went actually to the K headquarters when I was driving from Portland, Oregon to Seattle.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. I had tweeted them and said, like, hey, can people just stop by and buy stuff? And they're like, absolutely. What time are you coming by? We'll be expecting you. And so I went in there, and the people that work in there were very nice. I was hoping to run into
Calvin.
Calvin, yeah, he was not there. But the people that were
Calvin.
There, yeah,
Mr. Deep Voice.
Calvin. but the folks there were very nice, and I still walk around with a K-Records pin on my jacket in the fall and spring. So
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the K sound and the.
When did this happen? When did you go there?
This happened in 2010, 2011.
That's very cool.
Maybe, yeah. Just, you know, kind of happened on a whim, but was super cool, you know. And K Records, for those that don't know, is a legendary label. It's actually gotten in some hot water lately for owing people royalties.
Yeah.
Which is not cool, you know. But supposedly it was all very innocent. It was not. They were not pocketing the money for themselves.
It wasn't a Greg Ginn situation.
No, it was not a Greg Ginn situation. Yeah. But K-Records, they were like a very, very important pioneering label. And Beat Happening was sort of the big band from that time. Calvin Johnson on vocals and guitar. And, you know, it's just a... if it's not your thing, it's totally not your thing. You know, like... I'm pretty sure
it's like a lo-fi pop kind of thing.
Yeah, it's lo-fi pop. Yeah. There's a female voice that's pretty prominent there. But, like, you know, a lot of their songs aren't exactly in proper time. You know, it's not, the beat drops out here and there, not on purpose either. Just, you know, they were pretty untrained.
But super influential. I mean, it's basically like, you know, when you think about all the bedroom recordings that kind of came out in the 90s and beyond. I mean, you know, or even like a Conor Oberst kind of thing. I mean,
yeah.
You know, K Records, you know, Beat Happening is that's where it started, right?
Yeah, and they put on this festival for a number of years called the International Pop Underground.
Yep.
And, you know, bands like Fugazi would drive across the country to play at this thing. And, like, I can't imagine a more bizarre pairing than Fugazi and Beat Happening. But, like, that was the underground at the time, you know? It was just, there were strange bedfellows. And, you know, they were very progressive in a lot of ways. Like, I have a Beat Happening, or K-Records documentary on DVD, rather. And, they talk about how at the first festival they did, they made sure that there was vegan food options. Like, this was like the late 80s, you know. No, the word vegan was like such a weird term at the time, you know. And they were on that, you know. They were very socially progressive. You know, there were some transgendered artists on the label very early on, you know. It's just it's incredibly important. And while I think Beat Happening's records got better from there, I think almost everything you need to know about the band you can find there. You know, it's a really good introduction to the band.
That first album is 23 minutes long.
Yeah, and it's like what, songs. How many songs? 12 songs, yeah. 12.
Yeah. And then they came out with a reissue that was like 42, but like, you know, a lot of the songs, it's just like, it's another cassette where like a lot of the songs are the same, but like, you know, different recording or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, it starts there.
Yeah.
That's great stuff.
That's my first. What's your first? Your number five, rather.
My number five is, it's a band, again, like, I actually became aware of this band a few years after this came out, but it's Camper Van Beethoven's Telephone Free Landslide Victory.
We will be talking about that album later.
Okay. We'll save that for later then. What's your number four?
Talking Heads, Little Creatures.
Oh, okay.
Not the best Talking Heads record.
No, but good.
Yeah. Did you happen to watch the show Documentary Now?
You know what? I've been meaning to. I know they just did a thing on Talking.
Yeah, about. Last night was that they did a like incredibly spot on Stop Making Sense parody. Like, it's amazing the amount of detail they went to. Like, even the film stock looks the same. Like, you know, it's just really, really a loving. It's
Fred Armisen and Bill Hader.
Yeah, and Seth Meyers.
Yeah. That's I've been meaning to check that stuff out.
Especially if you know the source material, it's great. But, you know, Little Creatures, you know, it's this is after Brian Eno had stopped producing the band. But it had, you know, I would say most Talking Heads fans are aware of And She Was and Road to Nowhere and Stay Up Late.
Stay Up Late, yeah. I mean, they were getting a lot of rock radio airplay at this point. So, like, all those songs I've heard thousands of times.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And this is sort of the moment where, you know, it's right after Stop Making Sense, and this is where it becomes very clear that Byrne is the driving force behind the band.
Yeah.
You know, I think he always was, but it becomes much... It becomes almost a dictatorship.
It was more of a band in the early days, and then... You know, I think, I mean, because he basically brought in all those additional players for, like, you know, when they kind of went down the funk and African music road. But, you know, yeah, I think by this point it was just like, all right, you guys do this. And now maybe we'll get a different drummer to play now and a different bass player. And, you know.
Right.
And then, yeah, basically the rest of them were like, all right, fuck you. But yeah, I mean, this album, I think it did pretty well. I mean, it was.
Oh yeah,
I heard like you could hear like, And She Was got like Road to Nowhere a ton of play. Like, I, you know, videos were on MTV all the time. Even well, like
the record peaked at number 20.
Yeah,
in the US, and Road to Nowhere got to number. I mean, in the US, it was not quite as successful, but in the UK, Road to Nowhere was number 6 top 10 hit. You know,
really? Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, it was the band's biggest selling studio album. There you go. 2 million copies.
Wow, yeah.
Best album of the year in the Village Voice Paz and Jop Critics Poll.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I've never owned it. I have pretty much every other Talking Heads album, I think. And it's not because I don't want... I think it's just because I love the other albums so much more.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the only... You know? Any album of theirs before this... Remain in Light
is just like, yeah, you know. Yeah. And even Stop Making Sense was just amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, great album.
That's my number four. What's your number four?
My number four is Love by The Cult.
Ding. I always forget you're a big Cult guy.
Yeah, I mean, you know. And this is like, you know, it's funny because, like, you know, the next Cult album, which, you know, when we did the 1987, was on my list, which was Electric. But Love, I mean, those two albums sound so different. I mean, you know, Love is really kind of, you know, the original Cult sound, which is more of a goth kind of thing.
Well, they were the Southern Death Cult.
Yes, they were. And it's, it, you know, and really, like, I think, like, you know, I heard this first and, you know, was into this first, and I loved Electric more at the time. I think I love Love more now just because I appreciate the sound more. Like, Electric is kind of way more derivative because it's, you know, kind of like an AC/DC album, but, you know, done well. You know, it was Rick Rubin kind of came in, you know, this is what we're going to do. But yeah, like, this is a, you know, they just, like, and I just think, you know, songs like Rain and She Sells Sanctuary, which really was, like, the first song I had heard by them, are just, like, so, like, majestic. I mean, Billy Duffy is such a great guitarist. You know, it's an interesting, you know, obviously, like, I think Ian Astbury, the singer, you know, I think people either love him or hate him. But, you know, and later on, they kind of turned into a metal band almost because they,
yeah,
you know, they were really just, like, you know, they hit it big, like, when Sonic Temple came out, which was 89, they basically just, you know, they started to look and sound like, you know, Whitesnake a little bit, but like, this, you know, this album, they're really coming out of, you know, the same scene as, like, Bauhaus and stuff and bands like that, you know, early 80s, and, you know, a little different, but, you know, it's still, like, you know, I imagine they played a lot of bills with, you know, Jesus and Mary Jane and Bauhaus and bands like that, because, you know, it's just, like, you know, they're English and they're playing kind of this, you know, gothy sound that, you know, I'm sure there's a big Joy Division influence on them originally, you know?
Yeah.
You can hear it in the guitar on this album, certainly. You know, I think as they progressed and sort of hit the big time, and actually the follow-up album was called Peace, and they recorded it, and then I guess they scrapped it, and then hooked up with Rubin and did Electric, and they came out with an album called a couple of years ago called Electric Peace, which I guess is kind of like that originally scrapped album, which I have not heard, but I'd like to, because it sounds interesting. Because I think,
did they re-record it, or is it the original recordings?
It's a reissue. It's just
wow.
They just put it out. And I guess it's just sort of, you know, what they were going to release and then decided not to. So I've been meaning to check that out. But, yeah, they abandoned it. Yeah, they kind of just, you know, I think it was more along the lines of Love. And then, you know, it's got, I think, oh, yeah, it's got some of the same songs, but I think it's just a different sound. You know, they kind of had, was more that kind of gothic sound. So, you know, definitely an interesting band. I never got to see them live, which, you know, they, I mean, they're still touring and stuff. I wish I'd seen them back in the 80s, but, right. But yeah, that's my number four.
You are listening to Completely Conspicuous with Jay Kumar.
That wraps up episode 444 of Completely Conspicuous. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you join me next time when Brian Salvatore and I conclude our discussion about the best music of the year, 1985. In the meantime, check out BFF.fm every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 Pacific, to hear my radio show, Stuck in the Garage. You can find archive shows at mixcloud.com/coomdog. Jay Breitling produced the opening and closing themes of this show. Voiceover work is courtesy of James Graylian. Completely Conspicuous is a Tan God production.